When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Nick Lloyd, a professor of modern warfare, King's College London. His new book is The Eastern Front. Nick Lloyd. These are lands and territories and borders we talk about here in the 21st century because they're not settled. They can be threatened. And yet this is the moment leading to the Treaty of Versailles where all the Austro-Hungarian Empire's kingdoms are cut up and dealt out as if there's a deck of cards and they're choosing which ones they want to associate with. There were four results of the war. Four entities that come out of the defeated Central Powers. My list here, following Nick's reporting, the German-Austrian, and we'll see that again in 1938 and 39, Hungary, the Czechoslovakia, and the one that's most made up of pieces, Yugoslavia. None of those actually describe, well, Hungary does, describe a nationality that's homogenous. They all describe pieces of different nationalities. And the Austro-Hungarians felt that at the time. Was that, and the treaties you talk about, Nick, the treaties could be extremely punitive on these parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Was there a perception at the time that we're building a brittle organization that could fall apart again?
The collapse of these, you know, the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, you know, is devastating for the cohesion of the region. And obviously all of those, you know, there are a number of new states that emerge at this point. Poland, Czechoslovakia, obviously Yugoslavia and enlarged Serbia, Romania, in you know, grows, Hungary shrinks. It's very difficult to disentangle all of the competing ethnicities and national groupings in that part of Europe. And so it's incredibly messy and incredibly difficult to see. And this is what the victors have to deal with. Most of their time is spent trying to work out what is going to happen to Central and Eastern Europe, because it's almost as if a great vacuum has opened. The Russian Empire is dissolved and the civil war in Russia is taking place. And so Poland emerges, the states in the Baltics emerge, they're weak, dependent, you know, on patronage and support from the West. And of course, it's very, very unstable. These are weak states having to incorporate new ethnic groupings, having to build new ethnic national loyalties. And of course, they're not ultimately not able to stand. And that you know, story obviously goes through the up to the Second World War. And so the ultimately results of this, just the problems just carry on. They don't really get resolved in any form or way, or at least resolved satisfactorily.
There was a sense, I believe at some point you characterized it this way, that the war didn't end, that it moved to arguments that would lead to another go. The treaty you picked out as being the most punitive of all was the Treaty of Trianon. Do I say that correctly?
Yeah. Obviously, this is the one that you know, Hungary has bits torn off it from all the surrounding states. I feel very bad about it for decades. Indeed, it's still a sore point in Hungarian political life today. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those indications of the peace treaties, which don't necessarily really satisfy anyone. But they're very, very difficult decisions to make. And you have to reward your allies. You have to reward the partners that played a role in the defeating of the Central Powers. But This is just an indication of how dangerous the war is, and how it, you know, what emerges is not necessarily any better than what had preceded it. In many ways, is far weaker.
Yes, what I learned from you again, we return to those thoughts. War is manageable, raw. Being perceived as weak means you have to fight raw. Empires, these empires all crash, they're all gone. Is there sentiment, nostalgia about them?
I mean, I don't think there's much nostalgia for them at the time when they go in 1918. There may well be lingering groups, but I think there's a sort of bright new world that's opening up in some respects, or at least a brave new world. But of course, you do see increasingly a kind of nostalgia for the Habsburg Empire, a nostalgia even for the family of the Tsar Nicholas II in Russia, what's the sort of proto, you know, cult of personality with the Tsar. And you know, I think there's a feeling that, you know, Europe clearly lost something in that war, and, you know, lost a great deal, and kind of sense of European destiny and power, it has never recovered. And so, yeah, I think there is that nostalgia which sort of lingers over what the war did to Central and Eastern Europe. And going back to your earlier point, yeah, the war ends very clearly in the West, on the Western Front, but it never really ends in the East, or at least it goes on at least until the early 1920s before it's sort of settled, or at least temporarily.
I started to write down the Russian generals who are executed. Rennenkampf, the man who lost Tannenberg, and he's arrested and executed because he wouldn't join the Red Army. Alexeyev, what is the volunteer army?
Officers and men, predominantly officers, actually, from the old Russian Imperial Army that go south in increasing numbers as 1917 goes on, and particularly after the Bolsheviks take over, and they reform into the so-called volunteer movement, and they become known as the Whites, of course. Exactly what they fight for is still somewhat unclear, but obviously they're fighting against the radical socialists and Bolsheviks that now control the heartland, the center point of Russia, with Petrograd and Moscow. And Alexeyev is one of the volunteer leaders until he dies in 1918. But yeah, the war carries on in that sense. And that really surprised me, just the number of, because it's a story that's never really told in the West. You know, what happens to the Tsar's generals? Most of them, you know, either flee or are executed, and there's only a few that really get out of that period alive. Brusilov actually joins the Red Army, and of course he's never forgiven by his former comrades.
Conrad, where does he go?
Conrad retires and goes to Vienna and starts writing his memoirs, which are unfinished, and then sort of pens articles about how the war was forced on Austria, and it was a very glorious struggle, and they were really betrayed by their friends. And so, you know, it's quite of a, you know, he's trying to obviously justify his actions, as one would expect. But yeah, he sort of lives that for another 10 years, I think, before he finally dies.
Carl dies, very young man. I believe he's in his early 30s, in 1922 or 24. But today you tell me that the Pope is moving to make him a saint.
Yeah, I know there's obviously he's on that path to sainthood. Whether he'll get there, who knows? But obviously he there is a campaign for his, you know, believing that he was, you know, a peacemaker, a man who tried to bring the war to an end. One of the few who was largely blameless for the war, and obviously was deeply concerned with the welfare of his people, and obviously a deeply devout Catholic.
Right.
And so Carl is seen, I think, as a man who potentially had the chance to unite the empire one last time. And so there is that cult of personality around Carl, around the idea that he was a man of great wisdom and peace. And so, yeah, I end the book with Carl because I think it offers some kind of light
right
at the end, really.
I agree with you, Nick, and congratulations. The book is The Eastern Front, A History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. Nick Lloyd is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.